A lot of people call me Nate, but I'm really not picky. And I'm here to talk about pretty much anything related to telecommunications. I have an ever so rough outline that I don't even remember what's on it. So I'm just going to talk about this hour, I believe, is how circuits get from point A to Z. And this is going to cover, hopefully, a lot of stuff that J average consumer is not aware of about telephone service, about high-speed data service, fiber optics, things like that. I'm gonna start this with a little trivia that I like to do. Would anyone like to make a guess about when the first T1 circuit went into service?
Yesterday.
Earlier.
82.
Earlier.
67.
67. Getting closer. I believe it was 65. And the reason I ask that question at conferences like this is because a lot of data geeks think, you know, well, all right, the NSFNet went from a switch 56 to a T1 in like 90. You know, I don't know, sometime in the late 80s. And a lot of people don't realize that a lot of the things that are now considered really cool stuff in the data world have been done in the telecommunications, you know, for telephones, for decades earlier. And so I'd like to start off. Let's see if that, does that fire out of the screen pretty well?
Not from here, but if okay. You can scoot, switch yeah. places.
Well, I mean, does it need to be farther out there?
I don't know if they have overhead markers.
I do.
Okay. Do we have transparencies to write on, or can we just write on the screen?
I do.
Whoa.
Let's see how that lines up. I don't know how that aims.
Off mirror.
Okay. I don't want to break it. All right. Heck, let's start off. Yeah. Excellent. You know, I didn't want to. Well, that was... This. No, I'd really. I'd like to start off with a film strip and. That'll be over here. I didn't think through this terribly well, so. See what happens. What I'm going to start off with is getting my mic to stand still. Does everyone know how an analog voice circuit turns into a stream of digital bits? This is why I told Josh to show up.
Magic!
It is magic. Well, yeah, but the A to D conversion is something that is at the heart of the whole problem. Well, that comes later. That's what's fun. Yeah, so you've got this... Let's just take a reference line and go... Wee. And you divide it into time slices. And if you look at each one of these points and you say, okay, that was that level, that level, that level, like so... You come up with all these digital points on this. Sorry about that. Digital points that represent the values of that curve. And of course, they're a loose approximation because there can be much higher frequencies in here that your sampling frequency isn't going to tell you. You know, you lose. Nyquist says anything above half your sampling frequency. So. Yeah, so when you look at the... frequency range of human speech, you know, most of the information is below about 4,000 hertz. And you can definitely understand someone with a good bit less than that. So it sounds pretty decent if you say, all right, let's call it 4,000. And so what you do is you take an 8,000 hertz sampling rate, and if we use, say, you know, a whole bunch of levels, call it 8 bits per sample to represent that, you get 8 kilohertz times 8 bits is 64 kilobits per second, which just happens to be, you know, that's where the number comes from that gives us, you know, the 64K channel that defines pretty much everything in communications in terms of circuits. We've got the 56K modem, which is, if you take that 8 times 8 and make it 8 times 7, actually, you've got 8 kilohertz worth of samples, but only times 7 bits of resolution, because they steal the 8th bit for signaling. And the reason they do that is when you pack a whole bunch, let's see, I'm trying to think, I guess that was in the early 60s, late 50s maybe, they started playing with digitizing speech and sending these digital channels very long distance. And the nice thing about digital channels, of course, is any digital signal can be regenerated. If you get it before it fades too much, you can look at those levels, because it's either a 1 or a 0. And if it's a 0.8, okay, we make it a 1. If it's a 0.1, we make it a 0. And you can clean up this signal pretty much an infinite number of hops. As long as your repeaters are close enough to each other, you end up with a pretty clean output, as opposed to the way they used to do things, which was with analog repeaters that are nothing more than fancy amplifiers that would sit there and amplify the signal along with whatever noise it had picked up in the meantime. So digital transmission lets you do things like, you know, phone calls to London that are just as clear as phone calls next door, whereas in the analog days, phone calls to London were a miracle if they were clear, because that meant every analog amplifier along the line had to be perfectly balanced and you know, low noise circuits and everything. So they quickly realized that just digitizing a circuit and sending it on a pair of wires was nice for noise reasons, but it could also mean big gains in capacity. In the analog days, they would use frequency techniques to actually shift the frequency spectrum of a call up, you know, so you've got one person whose speech has been clipped between 0 and 4,000 hertz, and another person whose speech has been clipped between 0 and 4,000 hertz, but it's now been shifted up, so it's between, say, 5 and 9,000 hertz, and you've got another call whose speech has been shifted up, say, between 10 and 14,000, and you frequency shift all these calls, and then you take this new signal that has, you know, say, 0 to, you know, several megahertz, you know, let's say 0 to 5 megahertz would be a whole bunch of calls. And this is now essentially a radio signal. And you put that down a twisted pair or a coax line or something, and it would get to the other end. But, of course, because it's analog, you're amplifying the noise as you try and regenerate the signal. And every time you shift this frequency up and shift it down, you're introducing noise and you're introducing distortion. And all of that was counterproductive. When they were trying to get more and more calls onto smaller and smaller cables to run between offices, the quality was getting worse instead of better. So when digital electronics came far enough to do this, you know, process of figuring out, you know, at a time slice how high the level of that signal is at each of those time slices, and they could do this pretty reliably. Then what they started doing was multiplexing, which is where you take several slow data streams. Let's see, how do I want to draw this? And you essentially, you take from each onto a much higher speed line. Like that. And, you know, so you've got, you know, let's say an 8 kilohertz sampling rate here. And now if you just did a 3-to-1 multiplex, you'd end up with a 24 kilohertz sample times 8 bits. But anyway, on a higher speed circuit, you can carry all these things. And then at the other end, you can pull them back out and reconstruct those bits into exactly the digital signals that went in with ever so slight delay. And this is a funny thing. The analog systems introduced almost no delay. They were just moving the components of the signal up and down in frequency. With the digital system, you have to wait, you know, at least one sampling interval for your sample and hold and quantize and whatever they call all that stuff that Josh knows so much better. And then in your multiplexer, everything sits around for, on average, half a clock cycle. Depending on which channel you are, if you're one of the early channels, then you don't sit around at all. And if you're one of the late channels, you sit around almost an entire clock cycle. And then at the receiving end, where the demux happens, you've got all these components coming off the high-speed circuit and going out the low-speed interfaces. And you're putting all these bits out, but they all have to come out. You prepare an entire batch of them. You demux an entire frame, and then you say, okay, all the bits are ready. And then you demux another entire frame, and now all the bits are ready. And so every mux demux gives you a 1 clock delay. And this is normally not a problem. You figure, okay, 8 kilohertz, you can go, you know, a couple dozen or a couple hundred of these delays before any human starts to notice it. And it's certainly fine for data communications too. So that hasn't been an issue until you get into things like cell phones that do much weirder things. But what you can do with this voice channel here, you've got let's throw some numbers around. 8,000 hertz, 8 bits, is 64 kilobits per second times 24 voice channels. This is what they do in a T1, is you get 24 voice circuits worth of data onto a T1. And they picked this number because, well, the math comes out to 1.544 megabits, and that was a good number for the electronics of the time. 1.5 megahertz signal was what they could reliably amplify and demodulate and clean up and, you know, remodulate. And so T1s were used very early on just to move voice circuits from office to office. And the problem, if you go back to the days of step-by-step or crossbar switches, is that you have you've got actual physical pieces of metal that are moving into place when someone places a phone call to connect the circuit. And that's all analog. It's actually working with the audio on the wire. And so if you've got a call that starts at office A, goes to office B, which switches it around to office C and goes to office D and then to the subscriber, you've got those links between the offices where it gets digitized and sent and then turned back into analog and switched and turned back into digital and sent between offices back into analog and switched. And all those multiple conversions make all sorts of noise in the signal. So it was important, as soon as digital transmission became widespread, to also have digital switching. And they developed the electronic switching system. They developed the number 4 electronic switching system because the previous series of electronic switches were electronically controlled, but they were still analog switches. Number 1 ESS, which there are still lots of around. There are several in Detroit that I know are still operating. There's a computer that you know, takes the digits that you're dialing and figures out where your call is going. And it has all these peripherals. It runs Unix. That's what Unix was written for. And it asks its peripheral, where's your next open switching path? Okay, connect this path here. But the actual connection is done by relays. And so this computer is controlling an analog voice path. And 63, 67 maybe, I want to say, is when the first number one electronic switch went into service in New Jersey somewhere. Because Bell Labs are in New Jersey. And but you still had this digital analog conversion problem. And so the number 5 ESS is very common today. Pretty much everything out there is either Western Electric AT&T Lucent number 5E or Northern Telecom DMS-100, which is like, you know, they're competing nearly identical product. And the number 5 is obviously the direct descendant of the number 4, which was the first switching machine to deal with the signal in a purely digital form. Every line in a number 4 or 5 that goes to a subscriber is digital in the switch, even though it might be analog when it hits the subscriber. So then they had the ability to keep a signal purely digital from essentially from the point your line hit your switch through all the switches in between to wherever it terminated. And then the fascinating prospect turned up that we could keep it digital even farther. You know, you've got this analog pair that runs from your phone to your wall, down the street, you know, manholes and all that stuff, it back into the office, and then it turns digital, and the switch works with it and ships it to another switch to wherever. It turns back analog and goes out a pair to the other customer. And they said, what if we keep it digital? What if we put this analog to digital and digital to analog conversion stage in the user's house, in the customer's house? I'm sorry. Only computer people and drug dealers call their customers users. and thus was born ISDN. And so you have this terminal equipment or terminal adapter, whatever they call it, which does all the analog and digital conversion. And if you want to access that full 64 kilobit channel on ISDN for data, you can do that. And this was hot stuff in the mid-80s when it came out. I like to say ISDN was like mini disc. It was really cool 20 years, 30 years ago. And it's awfully funny that, you know, the price point didn't get down to where it would have gotten widespread adoption until it was already obsolete. So, let's see, where should I go next? Oh, I wanted to go. That analog pair, that pair that runs down the street from your house to the CO. This is always a big doodle. So I'm going to start off with the central office. And I'm going to make it really small in this diagram because there's another diagram to follow. And it's got a downstairs and an upstairs. And in the downstairs is the cable vault. And this is a room. Usually the lights are turned off and the door is closed and there's an exhaust fan running because at ground level, the cable vault is all underground and you've got these big conduits that come into it, usually all at one side of the building, and they go out to a manhole, you know, outside the office somewhere. And in these conduits run, you know, 12,000, 15,000 pair cables that bring in all the lines from the surrounding area. And soil gas leaks in there, and you get all kinds of radon and nasty things in the vault. And so there's a little vent fan over there somewhere that takes all those nasties out. But anyway, you've got these utility poles all over the place. Some people call them telephone poles, but there's a lot more than telephones on them. And if you go climbing up one thinking, oh, telephones are low voltage, you'll soon learn otherwise. So you'll have these cables that run, I'm going to start in the cable vault for now, and you've got, let's say, you know, 12,000 pair right there, and then there's another conduit that runs out of that manhole and up to the side of this pole with, let's say, I'm sorry, not 12,000, 1,200 pair. That's better. Let's say we've got a 500 pair that runs up here, and now it strings along these poles and comes down and gets to your block where it goes underground again. And for no apparent reason, this terminology has stuck in the industry where the large cable, let's say 500 pair and above, that goes from your neighborhood back to the office is referred to as the aerial cable. Even though it's probably underground in most modern communities, it's still called aerial. And then it goes back underground in your neighborhood where your house is. And my dad, the home inspector, would shoot me for that. But yeah, all right, let's give it a little soffit and a little vent stack. So now this pair comes underground and goes for a few feet and comes up in what's known as a cross box. And this thing is, it looks roughly like the video storage under your entertainment center. It's got doors that open. It's got like the faux wood grain panel on the doors and everything. And you open it up, and what you find inside is a cross connect, a whole bunch of cross connect blocks, because there is a, let's say at this point, 100 pair cable that runs down your street. And there's another 100 pair cable that runs down somebody else's street. And there's another 100 pair cable that runs down. And actually, ISPs, you're probably all familiar with the idea that an ISP will have, you know, X number of thousand incoming lines, and if they were all saturated at once, they would use, you know, X number of megabits of traffic. But they know that subscribers don't use all of their capacity all of the time, and so they actually have only a small fraction of that amount of capacity going back to, like, the internet. And the phone company has known this for a century, and so what they have is, say this is a 500 pair cable that runs back towards the office, they'll actually have 8, 9, 10 streets with, you know, 100 pair cables served off of here, because they have the capacity buried in the ground for every house to have 2 or 3 or 4 phone lines. And of course not everybody does, and so when you aggregate them all at a cross box like that, you can collect the pairs that are used onto the pairs that you have capacity going back to the office. And this happens at several stages throughout what's referred to as the outside plant. I'm not exactly sure where the term plant gets into this. I guess it does grow, but and things grow on it, which is the bane of every outside plant worker. Things grow on it, things chew on it, things piss in it. My general explanation for any sort of problem on an analog circuit is squirrel piss, because they love to get into the bottoms of these cross boxes and make little nests. And it's not always squirrels. Sometimes it's badgers, mice, and, you know, college students. I deserve that. I thought I could sneak in a badger reference there and nobody would catch it, but sometimes it's I'm not even gonna go to the other species, but so now you've got this 100 pair, or sometimes it's a 50 pair, maybe it's a 25 pair if you live on a small street. And it comes up to these little pedestals that are, they're the same concept as cross boxes, but they're smaller. And they have, oh, I drew that wrong. Yeah. There's not one in your basement. There's one near your house. And then there's like a 1 or 2 or 4 pair wire that actually heads into your house from here. Yes.
Cross box have in it that allows it to be able to switch amongst the cables coming out of it to what its head end is?
Punch down blocks and a lock on the door that allows the tech to get into it and manually change the connections.
Well, you indicated that there are less pairs going out of it than there are coming into it.
Right. And I misexplained that. I used the analogy of an ISP whose customers are dialing in, you know, minute by minute, might be using a channel, might be not, might be uploading a file, might be not. Whereas in this case, the question is month by month, who has a telephone circuit, does not have a telephone circuit. When you order a line from the phone company, they come out and they make the connection, and now you have a path back to the CO. in some countries. I've heard of this in Poland and in some other areas. There will actually be a small switch, a little step-by-step unit in that can. And, you know, there'll be 15 apartments in the building and two pair that run back to the CO, and it'll actually select among those. But we don't do that here. Yes? Yeah, it's all hardwired. There are jumpers in there. If you actually look into a crossbox, what you'll see is like one side of it, or maybe every other block, will be pairs heading back towards the CO, and then, you know, the other side of it, or the blocks in between, will be pairs heading towards the customer, and they simply make connections between the two to create a path. The overbuild in the network is for people ordering extra lines. It's not for minute by minute capacity changes. Ooh, you should take that up with your apartment buildings manager. Well, they can't fix the fact that it's an analog pair that someone can clip into. They can fix where it runs, and they can fix that, and they should. And your state public utilities commission would love to hear from you. Let's see. Anyway, there's an interesting thing that happens here, is that by default, there is no connection in one of these boxes until someone orders a line. And the nice thing about this is that you'll have pairs that run down your street, you know, that go from your house, and they appear, you know, in the can behind your house, and they appear in the can behind your neighbor's house and your other neighbor's house, and they appear in the crossbox, but they don't connect to a pair that goes back to the CO. And so if you wanted, you could be your own little phone company. You could sneak out there and use those pairs and you know, put your own jumpers in, and when they came out to, you know, use that pair for someone else's line, they would simply yank off your jumper and you know, maybe get a little irritated because the squirrels are really getting intelligent now. Yeah, maybe crows steal jumpers because they're shiny. I don't know, but I shouldn't endorse or condone this activity because it is illegal. These are not your property; they're the phone company's property, despite the fact that you're on your land. And that's how easements work, and that's funny. But anyway, the other nasty thing about this is that those pairs sit out there without anything on them, without any current flowing through them, and so even the connections that are there degrade. It's a little known fact that any sort of connection between metals, you know, simply because of moisture and humidity and all those things, will degrade. But if you have current flowing through it, it'll stave off that effect. And so when somebody orders a new line, and they go out there and they smack in those connections, it sucks. Because all these pairs, the terminals are dirty or whatever. And, you know, if you have a problem with the quality of that line, you want to tell them that very soon after they install it, so they can go back and clean it up as part of the install, rather than as part of a service order later. So, let's see. I think it's time to talk about what happens inside the central office. And this is... Yes? Can you speak up just a little?
Oh, why inductive coils don't allow for DSL. Couplings don't allow for DSL.
Okay, inductive loading coils are voodoo to anyone who is not deeply versed in analog signal electronics and nasty stuff like that. Why exactly they work is really tricky, in that the line has certain characteristics in the voice band. You know, it rolls off at a certain frequency, and by adding these inductive coils, you can give it better frequency response in one area at the expense of another. And it so happens that, it's my understanding, that DSL uses a whole much wider range of frequencies, and so by putting loading coils that would benefit one part of the spectrum, you'd hurt the rest, and it would be a net loss for DSL. Whereas it works because voice is a very narrow bandwidth. That's a rough guess. Yes?
What about situations where there's fiber between the CO and the neighborhood? How does it digitize?
Ah, good. I was going to get to that, but I'll get to that right now, because actually it's a good thing to do before getting into the CO. Yeah, forget diagrams. Essentially, what they'll do is they have what they call a slick or a subscriber loop carrier, which is a system that sits in a case which is larger than a crossbox, but in the same location in the network. You've got a big cable that runs back to the office, and in this case, it's not, you know, a big multi-hundred or multi-thousand pair cable. It's a pair of fiber that runs back to the office, but it's big in terms of capacity. And then what's actually in this slick terminal there is control logic and optical interfaces and multiplexers and demultiplexers and the entire set of circuitry that would have been in the switch in the CO, where your analog pair hits it and it converts it to digital, and it does things like tell whether you're on hook or off hook because there's current flowing or not flowing, and where it does things like connect ringing voltage to your line to make your phone make noise. All those things that would happen in the switch happen in a card in that slick terminal. And so what you'll see is if you're ever cruising around and you see one of these things open, it'll be a gray box, usually 3, 4, 5 feet tall, maybe about 2 feet deep. Same sort of swing out metal doors, and you know, invariably there will be a van parked there and some guy sleeping in the van. But
down by the river.
Yeah, but if you catch it with the doors open, stop and take a look, and you'll see there are three systems that are common, and one is gaining in popularity at the expense of the other two. Like the first slick was the Slick 5 by AT&T/Western Electric, and it was a hacked up D4 carrier, which I don't want to get into right now. But all it supports is analog channels. I mean, you can theoretically do 64K data through it, but it doesn't like to. And it's hard to maintain, and the parts are ancient. And it's gray, it's very gray, and it has little metal latches everywhere. And then there's the, that's the Slick 96. The Slick 5 is white and similarly limited. And then there's the Fujitsu digital loop carrier, which is beige and similarly limited. And then there's the Lightspan 2000 system by DSC or Alcatel, depending on what they're calling themselves this week. And it does all the same things, but it supports line cards that, in addition to doing plain old telephone service or POTS, you can get a T1 out of this thing, or you can get DSL actually over the slick. And you run into a situation in my neighborhood. We're served out of a slick, and we can't get DSL because, I mean, as the crow flies, we're well within 18,000 feet of the CO, but several thousand feet of that are on fiber, and the terminal at the end that turns that back into an analog line is not capable of DSL, and so we're stuck paying whatever the cable company decides they can take us for. So anyway, slicks are a lot of fun, and oh boy. that's another discussion for another time. But the birds of a feather room would be a great time to go into more detail about that. Yes?
I was just going to ask what slicks do to ISDN.
Most of them are capable of ISDN because it's a much older technology than DSL. I know the Slick 5 and the Fujitsu are capable of it. I don't know about the Slick 96. Probably not. But if you can get ISDN but not DSL, you're probably on a reasonably old but not really ancient Slick. Well, the Slick, the Lightspan 2000 is a combination Slick and DSLAM, whereas the older Slicks are not simply not capable of anything DSL related. If they wanted to, then in that same enclosure where they put the Slick, they could put a DSLAM, but they usually don't physically have space for it. These are small purpose-built cabinets. So, yes. No. If the Slick is fed with fiber, then chances are it does not physically have any copper going back to the CO. It has, you know, the local electric utility has dropped an electric meter there for it to run off of, and it just has fiber back to the CO. If they will sell you an alarm circuit, what they're probably doing is they have a special channel unit that goes in the Slick that detects current changes and simply repeats them as a digital signal back to the CO, or they're replicated on the other end. Probably not. Oh yeah, one other thing I should mention. Sometimes you'll see these Slicks in little enclosures of their own, and sometimes they'll be in what are called huts, which are about the size of a garden shed, except they usually have a flat roof. Sometimes they have a pitched roof and a huge air conditioner on the side of it. You can always tell there's something interesting in a building by the size of the air conditioner. All right, so I would like to start talking about the CO now, because it's organizationally interesting. The CO is a study in organization, I guess. A lot of these buildings have been standing since shortly after the turn of the century, and they've remained largely unchanged inside because they were well planned. And the idea of a cross connect is pretty universal and pretty efficient. And a lot of data people don't quite get the idea of a cross connect or a patch panel because it doesn't apply in their basement. You know, you've got a router and a hub and a machine here and a machine there, and when you want to connect one to the other, you just connect them to each other. You know, you run a cable all of 5 feet and it's no big deal. But let's say you've got a piece of equipment two floors away and you've got another piece of equipment, and they frequently have circuits between them added, removed. You don't want to be running, you know, a pair of wire up and down several floors every time. So what you do is you take the entire capacity of the one machine and you cable it down to a cross connect. And here's what happens. Let's see. I'm going to do the ground level and actually... And here's our CO. And in the cable vault, you've got your pairs that come in from outside. And that's, you know, a big honking cable. And it goes into a splice case that breaks it out into a bunch of 100 pair cables that come up onto the main distributing frame, usually on the first floor. And each one of these goes onto a block that, you know, takes that 100 pair and just brings it out so it's easy to connect to. And then your switch, you know, let's say your 5E is upstairs, and, you know, switch cabinets and all that stuff. And they have run all the cables for every pair that this thing is capable of serving down onto this frame, you know, through holes in the building that are designed for this purpose. And now when somebody orders a circuit, all they do is, doink, they run a jumper on the frame. And when somebody cancels the circuit, they take they take it back out. And if you've got you've got a cable coming in from here, and you've got a cable coming in from here, and back in, you know, in the purely copper world, somebody wants a circuit that goes from this neighborhood to this neighborhood, like an alarm pair, you just go noink, and it's done. And so all of the operations, you know, adding service, removing service, are done in one location for one type of circuit. And then you've got somewhere else in the office, you've got, well, of course, you know, these fiber optic cables have to come in somewhere, and they terminate in a, you know, a splice casing, and they come up to an optical cross connect, which is just, again, it's just a big patch panel. And all these fibers come onto the backs of little connectors. And all of the equipment in the office that's capable of handling an optical signal comes to this panel and terminates on the back of these little couplers. And to say, okay, we're going to take this fiber mux and put it on this strand of fiber that goes to that other office across the city, is just a jumper. And so you've got your optical cross connect, and you've got your analog cross connect, which is the frame. And then you'll have one for T1s and one for T3s. And so there's a cross connect for every type of signal. And where you end up, where it gets interesting, is that these outside pairs that go, you know, that take your POTS circuit, you know, from your house into the building, can also take a T1, you know, into the building. And so not only do you have POTS circuits coming out of the switch down to the frame, but you've also got whatever equipment is in the office that's dealing with T1s, what's called an office repeater, you know, that'll be somewhere else in the building, and it'll have pairs that come down to the frame. And some of these lines coming in are cross-connected over to the switch, and those are POTS circuits, and some of these lines are cross-connected over towards the office repeaters, and those are T1s. Were you asking something? Okay. So, let's see. Any questions so far on that? Yes?
Do they segregate, like, the CLEC equipment from the ILEC equipment?
Yes. Oh, I didn't leave enough floor space in my office. Let's build an addition on the side of the building. This is not uncommon.
Just put them in the attic.
they do that too. Actually, all these buildings have support columns that are usually enough to add several more stories. The number of stories depends on the building, but you can build them up as well as out. And usually that's easier because this gets into your parking lot, but. It fits on my paper better, so I'll do it here. And so you'll have actually, and this is the goofiest thing, a cage of like fence. And in this cage is the equipment owned by pretty much anybody who wants to be a co-locating customer. COVAD is like the big one. If you have Speakeasy DSL, if you have pretty much anybody's DSL except the phone companies, they go through COVAD because COVAD has a 10 by 10 square foot, sometimes it's a 10 by 20 square foot cage in the side of the office, and they've got cables that run on rack, which I have some of here and I'll show you, down to the frame. And when you get DSL service on your pair, if it's coming from the phone company, then it'll come out of their DSLAM. And if it's coming from COVAD, then it'll just go onto one of those pairs that runs up to that DSLAM. And the real interesting thing is letting these people in to work on their equipment without letting them into the rest of the CO. And so what you have is like a stairway out here and a little door at the top that says like co-location entrance. And it's really ridiculous because these fences are only 7 feet tall and the ceiling in the office is like 14 feet. And if you wanted to get from one area to the other, it would take you about 5 seconds. It keeps the honest man honest, but sometimes not that. What's that? I've never seen a camera inside except in the lobbies. They have cameras on the outside of some of them. In Ameritech territory, at least, I've heard of a couple cases where they suspected people of stealing, and they would set up a hidden camera somewhere. Never seen one. Whose territory? Okay. Well, maybe I don't know what to look for, but no. In the entranceway on the parking lot, yes, but in the equipment rooms, no. Yeah, at the really? Well, maybe the people in the cages in the offices I've been in are just honest enough they don't need to monitor them. I don't know. Maybe they're just not as suspicious. But yeah, they certainly should have cameras. Not that they always do, but
trusting Michigan folks.
I haven't seen it, but yeah. Oh, the other thing I should mention is that all the equipment in the office runs on DC. This is why if you've ever shopped for rack mount cases, sometimes you'll see an option for a DC input power supply that takes 48 volts DC positive ground. And pretty much anyone who's worked on electronics but not for the phone company says, positive ground? What on earth were they thinking? Negative 48 volts DC, what is with that? You know, ground is always negative. Well, no. Because, chemistry man, when you have salt in the ground and it separates, you know, because it's dissolved into a sodium ion and a chlorine ion, those are polarized, right? Which one's positive? The sodium ion. And so the chlorine is negative. And most corrosion that you're going to have in the ground would be due to chlorine ions. And so if all of your wires that are buried in the ground are either at ground potential or negative with respect to it, they're going to repel those negative ions. And they're not going to corrode as fast. And this is something Western Union noticed on the telegraph circuits way before telephones, was that, you know, the ones that were positive, they had to repair constantly because they would corrode, they would actually corrode so far they broke, and the negative ones were pretty much good as the day they were new. And so when Bell started, doing stuff on phone equipment, he was, you know, obviously it's all DC, but he made it all negative with respect to ground. And you've got this battery plant in the office, and that's also, you know, maybe somewhere else in the basement, where they have these racks of batteries that are roughly the size of garbage cans. And I shouldn't call them batteries. Those are cells. When you string them all together, they're batteries. But each one of these units, you know, that is, you know, 600 pounds when it's full of electrolyte and everything, is a 2-volt, you know, 1,800 amp hour cell. And there are 24 of them in series. And that's the A battery. And there's an identical setup a few feet away, and that's the B battery. And everything in the office has two feeds of DC. And it can run on either one. You know, normally it uses half and half. And the whole thing's designed never to go down. So the commercial power that comes in the office goes to big rectifiers. And they take that, you know, they take the, usually it's 480 AC, and they just turn it into 48 DC and dump it at the batteries. And the argument about whether the office runs on the batteries or runs on the rectifiers is silly. You know, it runs on whatever DC is available, and it's replenished by the rectifiers. But when it's a lot of fun when they come in to test the backup system. Because, you know, it'll run for 8, 10, 12 hours on those batteries in the event of a commercial power failure. But after that, you have to, you know, put some power back into the system. So there's a big generator somewhere. You know, they can be turbo diesels. They can be plain old turbines. But they have these tremendous underground storage tanks. You know, a couple thousand gallons, couple dozen thousand gallons. of usually kerosene. And the generators are not auto-start because they don't use them often enough, and auto-start systems fail. And it's staffed all the time anyway, or nearly enough all the time, that when a power failure happens, you know, the CO tech, it better watch his watch, and if the power failure runs more than an hour or so, he'd better get down to the office and you know, check the fuel level and start the generator and all that stuff. But when the power failure happened last August, I don't know if anybody here is from outside the affected region, but okay, I see a couple hands. Lucky SOBs. Actually, it was a lot of fun. It was like a big party, but you know, except for the lack of air conditioning. Cell phones went down pretty quickly because an individual... What's that?
Pagers.
Mm-hmm. Because the equipment at the cell sites on those little towers isn't big enough to justify a generator. You know, it's a little cabinet, serves, you know, maybe a couple dozen or, you know, however many concurrent customers, and it's got batteries. And in a region, the cell phone provider will have, 50 towers in an area that all come back to one switching center, and they'll have maybe three or four generators on little trailers, and when power fails to a cell site, they hitch the generator up to a truck and drive it out to that cell site and plug it in, and that site stays on the air. When power fails to all 50 sites simultaneously, well, you pick three and you tow the generators out there and you keep them on the air, and the others just drain their batteries and go flat. But the COs serving the landline equipment are centralized enough that every one of them does have a backup generator, and every one of those generators is tested every 6 months. And there are several people assigned to every office to cover it. You know, no matter what happens, there will be somebody who can make it in and start the generator and let it run and cut the whole thing over. Hello.
Hey.
Is it you guys over? You done over there?
You guys have an organ for here. Fucking use it.
You can have it back.
I'm busy but... with it. We're done.
Okay. Well, what do you want it for?
He has photographs that. I don't want to work for transparency.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That was the most random thing. They're coming out of the walls now.
Take this opportunity to point out that I put pictures of the inside cross-connect cans up on the gallery.
Ah, okay.
So if you want to see what they look like on the inside,
go
take a look at the gallery.
Do you have a video out on that?
Yeah, I do.
There's a second projector up here. So, anyway, it is 2 minutes to seven, a minute and 20 seconds to 7 o'clock. So if any of you are going to see the other session, I don't know what it is, feel free to leave now, and I won't be offended. And I'm going to kill this for a minute. Let's take about a two-minute break and get that up. And the hands-on part is next.